Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland and to KBOO.fm on the web. The time is 9:03, and that's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. The mole is the beast that works underground to expose and undermine the foundations of capitalist society, to show how power is concentrated in the hands of those few who own and control the great wealth that gives them leverage over the lives of the vast majority. But at crucial moments in history, the mole breaks out and not only creates unexpected molehills, but begins, as the song says, to tear that mountain down, that mountain of capital that casts such dark shadows over our lives. Thus it is today. This past weekend, some 4 million, mostly young people whose future lives are at stake, demonstrated in cities around the world for real action now to confront climate change. The New York Times remarked, "Rarely, if ever, has the modern world witnessed a youth movement so large and wide, spanning across societies rich and poor, tied together by a common, if inchoate, sense of rage." Unquote. We heard last week on the Old Mole from some young people here in Portland who were far from inchoate, but very articulate about why they were organizing for last Friday's event at City Hall. Today we'll hear from some of those who participated. They'll tell us how it went and what's next for the movement, which is not going away. This next Friday at Extinction Rebellion in Portland, along with 350.org, will be rallying at City Hall, this time to bring pressure on our city government to make Portland free of fossil fuel emissions by 2030. We'll talk with one of the organizers. Those who own and profit from the continued burning of fossil fuels are a tiny minority of the world's population. We who suffer and will increasingly suffer from it are multitudes. The advantage of numbers is ours, but only if we organize. This is the lesson we can learn from the history of the labor movement. General Motors cannot make money selling cars if workers will not manufacture them. That's the power of the strike. Here in Portland, where Fred Meyer has been underpaying its workers and paying women workers less than men, the workers are organized. They have a union with which the company has to negotiate. And if what the company offers does not meet the workers' demands, the workers can go out on strike. As the negotiations continue, they are asking us to join with them by boycotting the stores. We will hear later on today's show from a union representative. The power of the multitude, that's us, can be far greater than the power of the owners, but only if the multitude organizes and acts. And that's what is happening all over the world around climate change and here in Portland around a living wage. If we, the people, stand up for our rights, not just the rights in the Bill of Rights, but the right to a livable planet and the right to a livable wage, the wealthy minority who now holds so much power will see it slip from their fingers.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Life is real.
And that's Bob Marley here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, where we are talking about people standing up for a livable planet, and later in the show for a livable and equitable wage. Well, as I mentioned earlier, and as you probably know from the news or from your own direct experience, there was a massive demonstration on Friday at City Hall here in Portland. But that's not all, folks. There will be another rally there this coming Saturday, organized by Extinction Rebellion and 350.org. And here with me in the studio is Diane Meisenhelter, a longtime environmental, education, and labor activist who is currently volunteering with Extinction Rebellion's Action Working Group. So, Diane, briefly, could you give us sort of the headline for this event? And welcome to KABU, by the way.
Thank you. So the rally is on Friday at noon on the 27th of September, and it's in front of City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue, and we're going to be delivering demands to the mayor and city council, and the event is called Slow Motion Commotion, It's About Time, and it's about time for climate action. This is near the end of a week of climate actions, and this rally will feature a haunting song as well as satirical street theater designed to figuratively and literally push the city forward and put them on notice that climate activists are not going away and that we will be holding them accountable. We're demanding that the city set up concrete action timeline for reaching net zero emissions by 2025 with measurable goals for each year. And by December this year, we expect an action timeline for 2020 in line with that goal, starting with Zenith. The message is if they persist with slow motion, they can expect more commotion.
So, Diane, how did Extinction Rebellion get started and what's its mission?
So last October, when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change announced that we have less than 12 years to turn things around or risk the dire consequences of climate catastrophe, Extinction Rebellion started in London, and they were expecting just a few people for a rally, but 6,000 showed up, and so they were able to close down bridges, take over all kinds of public space, and basically in the middle of Brexit forced the government to negotiate, declare a climate emergency, and start to negotiate on concrete climate actions. In June, after another round of disruption, they were able to get citizens' assemblies started up. And the goal of their four demands of the U.S. climate, because now Extinction Rebellion has spread to over 49 countries internationally. And in the U.S., there are four demands. The first one is to declare a climate emergency. The second one is to develop concrete actions to push governments to develop concrete actions towards net zero emissions by 2025. The third is to have citizens' assemblies that oversee that process to make sure that it is done right. And the fourth is a just transition that prioritizes the most vulnerable peoples, indigenous sovereignty, and frontline communities. Mm-hmm. So we are working hard to push our local government, which has been very, very slow since that declaration last October. The city hasn't come up with concrete actions and instead have, in fact, with the expansion of Zenith, created a terminal for the export of tar sands oil overseas, going against policies that they were pushed to create in 2016, which included a no fossil fuel infrastructure. It took them 6 months just to schedule a public hearing on Zenith, which was basically to announce that they were going to grant them the permits. So we don't have that kind of luxury of time of non or detrimental action, which is why we're calling for city accountability with concrete plans, with timelines. And we support the youth demands. Last Friday's climate strike, where 20,000 Portlanders took to the streets to support climate action, and a primary part of youth demands was for an inclusive process, bringing grassroots organizations, youth, and frontline communities to the table with the city to develop a climate resolution, and the city taking climate into account in every action they consider. But to really address climate crisis, the city has to be more than reactive. In order to reach net zero emissions, they need to be proactive with a timeline actionable timelines and a plan.
Yeah, that sounds great. So tell us again a little bit more about what's going to happen then on Friday, and when and where people should be and what they're going to experience.
Yes, so we're outside of City Hall at 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue at noon on Friday. And we will be delivering our demands to the mayor before the rally. And hundreds of people signed on to those demands last Friday at the climate strike. And it'll feature a haunting song about extinction, as well as satirical street theater designed to push the city forward and say that we will hold them accountable and that we want quarterly reports, we want concrete actions. Right now, if global warming is the IPCC says there's threats to food security, water supply, human security, if global warming is not contained at 1.5 degrees centigrade, but we're on a path towards at least 3.7 degrees, at 4 degrees, over 60% of crops globally are likely to fail. So we have to act now.
Right. Okay, that sounds like a great event, and where people will enjoy themselves as well as learn a lot and be motivated to keep going.
If you can't make it to the rally during lunch hour, come to our regular Tuesday meetings at 6 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, Northeast 20th and Killingsworth, starting October 1st.
Okay. Thank you very much, Diane, for being with us today. So we've been talking about climate change action that will be coming up this Friday, and now let's turn to an assessment of what went down just last Friday at City Hall. A week ago on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talked with three young people, two of them local high school students, about their plans and hopes for Friday's climate strike action, or for that Friday's action. Now Bill is back to review the results with Jenna Paris, Jackson Calhoun, and Sriya Chinnan, who also worked on the event. Here's Bill.
Hi, folks out there in Radio Land. Yesterday, around the world, in Portland, too, will likely be remembered as the Great Climate Strike, organized by the Youth of the Planet, millions and millions of young people and adults too, rallying and marching in over 150 countries, demanding that the powers that be act to stop climate change and global warming. That climate science demonstrates will ultimately lead to human extinction. But we can, of course, stop that. It'll require dramatic change, near, in fact, complete transformation of how we produce, consume, and live. There are important forces in the world who don't want to change. It's going to be a great struggle in the future. And you folks around the table are going to be involved in that for quite a while, I believe. And it's wonderful work because the possibilities of what the change could bring would do a lot for human fulfillment and happiness. So today in the studio, like last week, but with a slightly different cast, I have Portland students, Jenna Paris, Sriya Chinnan and Jackson Calhoun. We're going to discuss the strike, what it accomplished, and what must come next. Jenna, Jackson, Sriya, first introduce yourself and discuss your role in the Portland climate strike. Who wants to go first?
Hi, my name is Jenna Paris. I'm a junior at Cleveland High School. Along with Sriya and Jackson and a few others, we were all some of the main youth organizers of the climate strike that happened yesterday.
Yeah, I'm Jackson Calhoun. I use he/him pronouns. I go to Rex Putnam High School. I'm a sophomore. Exactly what Jenna said. Specifically, I worked a lot on logistics, and then that got boring. So I did some stuff with press towards the end, and a lot of work at my school.
Unlike Portland public schools, it sort of allowed you not to attend school with Rex Putnam didn't go along with that program, but you did organize a rally in the school. A strike rally. How did that go?
Yeah, that went really well. Better than I was expecting. I'd say like 200 students probably walked out, and then out of that, probably 20 went into Portland. I was very proud of what we did at our school.
My name is Sriya Chinnan. I'm a senior at Lincoln High School. Yeah, I've just been working with these amazing youth activists for the past, like, I think it's been a month and a half now. For planning the strike that happened yesterday, I did outreach for a while, and I also organized in my school. We had 1,100 students walk out from Lincoln. although I can't discount that Lincoln is one of the most more economically and racially privileged schools.
It's so. Also very nearby.
Exactly.
And you have some wonderful faculty mm-hmm. at Lincoln.
Yes.
Did you folks have teachers who in classes where you studied climate change?
At Cleveland, the chemistry teachers on their own decided that they were going to teach climate justice as a unit within their sophomore chemistry classes because they felt like it was imperative that the students were learning about it. But it was something that they decided to do on their own. It wasn't from the district and it wasn't from any higher direction. They decided it all on their own and they wrote it all and they taught it to the students, but it was only the sophomore chemistry classes that got that.
What about Rex Putnam?
I have not learned anything about climate justice at Rex Putnam, which is sad. Our demand to our school was to do what Portland Public Schools is doing, except faster, with the climate justice curriculum, and I don't know what's going to happen with that. They said, oh, we're already doing it, and then, yeah, I doubt that.
Let's talk about the march. I found it really inspiring and wonderful and deafening, however. There
yes.
really was a lot of noise coming out of that full block of people.
Lots of good noise.
Yeah. How did you? You must have felt really good.
Yeah, we were expecting about 6,000 to 8,000 people mm-hmm. to show up, and I think over 20,000 yeah. people showed up. And that yeah. was super inspiring. I was really proud of my city.
That entire, like yesterday, I like blacked out through that experience. It was absolutely surreal. It was mm-hmm. awesome.
I think it was like the best day of my life because it
really?
Was so amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, people everywhere are getting involved.
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing. All around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I know the strike wasn't a one-time thing. This is a one step in what will be a long struggle and a building of movements. Tell us what's going on in Portland just to keep things going, but how you see this long struggle?
Well, on Tuesday, Portland has several things happening. The vigil at Zenith starts, for one thing, and that's going to be 60 hours long, so if anyone wants to go to that, they definitely should, because we need to stop Zenith, and that's one thing we need to do.
Before you continue, I just want to interject that you don't have to be there for all 60 hours. That's an important note. I'm definitely not going to be there all 60 hours. I think it's like 3-hour shifts, or even if you went
yes.
for 1 hour, people would be like, you're amazing. So,
come show your support.
Yeah.
Where is Zenith on the map?
It's the sidewalk near the Zenith Energy Facility, which is at 5501 Northwest Front Avenue. It'll start Tuesday, September 24th at 7 a.m. and it'll end on 7 p.m. at September 26th.
On Thursday.
And we're stopping tar sands oil
mm-hmm.
coming through Portland. There's something also happening this Friday, I believe.
This Friday, there is
a rally
it's
at
called
City Hall.
About Time, Act Now on the Climate Crisis rally at City Hall. And there's going to be street theater there. It's from 12 to 2. And it's the end of the week of climate actions. And it's basically to just tell the city we're not going away and we're holding it accountable to put forward concrete actions with real timelines to reach net zero fossil fuel emissions by 2030. There will be a lot of organizations there, like Extinction Rebellion, 350 PDX,
Sunrise.
Oh, good. So this is sort of a continuation and an announcement that this is not ended. We're continuing.
Yes. We will be following the strike with a week full of action, and there's more information for that on climatestrikeoregon.org. Visit it, join a group, go to these events, learn more.
I'm talking to three veterans of the, still in high school, veterans of the struggle who were organizing this amazing climate strike rally and march on Friday, September 20th. And we've been discussing the immediate future in Portland. Let's talk about the long-term future. Corporate America recognizes that the threat of climate change and then the demand for a Green New Deal are becoming much more popular. It's come out of the ashes, risen from the ashes of the old to begin challenging the entirety, actually, of the production system. They recognize they're in trouble, and I believe they also think that, and in fact, I'm sure of it, they also think that climate change could be another profit center. And the Green New Deal, if it appropriates 500 billion or a trillion as part of sort of an infrastructure project, whatever it would be, whatever they call it, there's really good money to be made. I'm afraid that all those monies may flow to corporate America rather than flowing to the cities. Change has to come to the cities, how they produce, consume, how people live. There has to be dramatic changes. Those have to come in the population areas of the country, and those are the cities. And so I think that, when we have a Green New Deal, at least the Ocasio-Cortez Green New Deal and the Bernie Sanders Green New Deal, envision those cities taking control of their energy supply as well as changing their transit systems, their building systems. To what extent have you folks been thinking about the question of who's going to control the Green New Deal? Where is the money going to go? Is it going to go to the investor-owned utilities, or is it going to go to the cities to create much cheaper and quicker to build and easy to repair off-the-shelf energy systems?
I think many would probably call me a dreamer, but when I envision a Green New Deal, I envision that the power is with the people, and I envision that states and cities are making their own decisions.
Yeah, I think, as you said, this is Ocasio-Cortez and Sanders' Green New Deal. So I think obviously when they were trying to get this bill passed, I don't think that the envision was for this all to go to corporate America. I think it's definitely, the hope is for it to all go to the cities and go to the people, as Shreya said.
The cities and the countryside and the tribes and all the affected people with a climate justice vision. And jobs in the cities, too, not in building this humongous grid that there's only a few construction companies that can do it and huge engineering firms. In the cities, the city grid and the city installations can be built by anybody who's ever built a kitchen or a home. All the trades can easily put up solar panels. Putting up a huge grid across mountains and rivers and the rest, doing a lot of environmental damage in the process because it has to be highly secure and highly engineered and take a long time to do. That's another matter. Jackson, are those issues alive in the movement?
Well, I wanted to speak to your last question about who we want to be benefiting and controlling the Green New Deal, and I wanted to say I think the frontline communities and the indigenous leaders need to have their voices very much listened to and respected, and they should be the ones leading this all, because they're the ones that most affected, and for indigenous people, they know the land best. The whole goal, I think, is to decolonize and decorporatize. So in trying to transition to a more sustainable world, we have to make sure that we're not doing it in a way that is making us more colonized.
I think engaging the frontline communities is something that's incredibly important, as Jackson's talking about, decolonizing. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, I mean, with colonization came the idea that, like, came greed and came corporate America. Like, it started with colonization to corporate America. There's a lot of similarities, and in order to really grow and in order to give the power back to the people that this land is, like, they are part of the land, we must continue to decolonize ourselves.
And decorporatize and democratize, I think. It's not impossible because there's a lot of cities already in the country and the world who have, in fact, moved very close to zero carbon, not in all of their transport. It's all the automobiles and buses and things aren't all electric. But in lots of ways, they produce clean energy within 50 miles of the city, some bigger installations, many smaller installations, and they also conserve energy rather than being so wasteful. And the capital costs then go way down because you don't have to build as many installations. There are many cities that do it. Have you folks studied these possibilities? Because we do have models.
I know that in Copenhagen, they have shifted the culture around biking and have, like, pushed biking rather than using your car and have, it's called, like, the Copenhagen method, where they have the sidewalk, they have the bike lane, and then they have parked cars, and then they have the driving lane, so bikers feel more comfortable and they feel safer when they bike, and that has actually encouraged a lot of people to use their bike around Copenhagen.
Yeah, it's so much healthier, too. Mm-hmm. People
yeah,
now
exactly.
enjoy life and enjoy breathing.
Yeah.
there are so many gains. They also have electrified transit systems all over Europe, actually. Mm-hmm. And they also have long-distance trips that are very efficient and fast and clean. I hope you sort of begin engaging in the issues that I've tried to raise. It would be good to look at those possibilities, the ways in which our cities, and led by the people who are most effective, they have to have a powerful voice in the movements. But the city movements are also extremely important, city movements around transit and around the way we produce our energy and who controls it and who profits from it and the jobs that are created. All of those are going to be great struggles within the cities and countryside. It's really important to not be fooled when they say, yeah. We have a $500 billion program for doing a smart grid. It's going to be great for everybody.
I think we've definitely been learning to be skeptical through this process of just being activists. We're definitely skeptical. I think that through this process, we have all learned to be very skeptical of what we hear from many adults and from many bureaucracies.
Yeah, it's a constant struggle to just be doing this work. They always make a lot of promises, you know, but you can't really trust everything that they say. There's a lot of empty promises, and there's a lot of like, oh, no, we support you guys totally, but there's no action behind those words, and there's like...
And they never really want you to know that they have made these decisions because of us and because of this movement. They're just like, oh my God, this is happening, but they don't really ever give us credit or recognition. So strikes and movements like this are crucial for the political process.
Yes.
Thanks.
I don't know if this is going to cut or not, but I'm going to just say it. To everyone out there in Radio Land, I just want to say that you guys all have the power to make a difference. No one is too small to make a difference. As Greta Thunberg, a 16-year-old Swedish activist, has said, join a group, go to climatestrikeoregon.org, and go to these events. The power is in you.
Imagine no possessions.
Okay, John Lennon, you know, like Bill, it's hard not to be inspired by these ideas, by the energy in particular and the commitment of the millions of young people standing up to governments and corporations and demanding not just actions within the existing order to reduce carbon emissions, but that the whole way in which we use and produce energy be transformed under the direction of the people. These young people know that it will take a mass movement united in solidarity to make this happen. And this is a lesson that the labor movement has long been teaching us, that a few workers isolated from each other, like a small group concerned about the climate, is helpless. But a union makes us strong, especially when the union is bonded with the larger community. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the union representing Fred Meyer workers has called for a consumer boycott as they continue to negotiate for decent and equitable wages. And here is the old mole's Joe Clement to talk with Kelly McAllister, Communications Director of United Food and Commercial Workers. This interview was recorded last week.
Well, this is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined today by the Communications Director of UFCW 555, that's United Food and Commercial Workers, the Grocery Workers Union. They represent Fred Meyer's, Albertsons, and a bunch of other grocery stores you probably go to. We are here today to talk about a labor struggle you've probably heard about because it's going on right here in our town. Fred Meyer's workers are demanding a lot of things. They're bargaining with Kroger, the parent company that owns Fred Meyer's. And Kelly here is going to recap some of the broad aspects of that recent history, but I wanted to talk especially about a very important campaign they have to address the gender wage gap. Kelly, could you just tell us a bit about where Fred Meyer's Kroger store workers were before the contract and what they were going for in the contract and where they are now?
So when we started bargaining, it was about 15 months ago, we bargained with the Unity Bargaining Team, which means that we are able to bargain on behalf of 20,000 of our workers at once. So that includes everybody who is a union member at Albertsons, Safeway, Fred Meyer, QFC, and a variety of what are called Me Too stores around the state. So that includes Sherm's and Ross and so on. So this is a lot of people in a lot of different contracts, 90-some contracts that we're looking at all at once. And we ran into, as you said, sort of a stall when the employers were unwilling or unable to make headway on the wage question. Our workers have been chronically underpaid for a while. It's one of those things that we're seeing everywhere in the country with income inequality in general, but particularly as you see cost of living go up and wages not go up comparably, then you run into a situation where it's really hard to keep your head above water. So we were negotiating for two things on the wage front. One of them is an increase in wages for everybody, because even our highest paid workers aren't sufficiently compensated for what they do, but also to look at starting the process to reach gender equity in these stores. A lot of grocery stores have a two-tiered wage schedule, and that has been causing some problems that we were able to document this time around.
From what I read, there's a two-wage tier in the contract for Fred Meyer's workers, one that is generally higher paid, one that's generally lower paid, and that in the lower paid one, women are overrepresented among all the people in those classifications. In the higher paid one, men are overrepresented in all those classifications. What is the union's response to that disparity? What is closing the gender gap really look like?
So we have expected to see this for a while. We think this is something we've suspected, but we didn't ever have the data to back it up until this time around. During the bargaining process, we received information that allowed us to demonstrate that in these two different schedules, as you said, men are overrepresented in the higher paying one and women in the lower paying tier. So the higher paying one is called Schedule A and the lower paying one is called Schedule B. And Schedule A is things like grocery, produce. Some of our checkers are in Schedule A. Schedule B has things such as bakery and the deli. And of course, the irony of these lower paid jobs is that the deli is widely agreed upon to be the most difficult job in the store. It's also one of the most dangerous because they're dealing with, you know, the slicing machines. And so that's an incredibly difficult job that has been put into this lower paying schedule. So we see a mirror image when we looked at the numbers. Two-thirds of men are put into Schedule A, two-thirds of women are put into Schedule B. And the average hourly difference between those two schedules is $3.53, which is extraordinary when you're looking at the difference between, you know, somebody making $17.22 an hour and somebody making $13.69 an hour. That's the difference between being able to survive and not. And then we extrapolated that further, and we looked for that average hourly difference over the course of a career. That could add up to a loss of $250,000. And we've noticed that the way that this mechanism for discrimination exists, the managers, the employers get to choose where to put people. So you apply to a job, and you're given a job. And at the apprentice level, at the very beginning, most of those jobs pay the same, so it doesn't look like it's a problem. It's after you've gone through those apprentice scales and you've put in those 8,800 hours of work to receive the journeyman status, that's when all of a sudden Schedule A sees a huge bump and Schedule B does not. We then took this information and passed along the raw data to a third-party company called Olympic Analytics. And the reason we did that is that we wanted to see whether or not our conclusions were statistically rigorous, you know, whether someone who was looking at it simply from a statistical point of view would see the same things that we were. And sure enough, they saw all of the same things and more. They saw that women are twice as likely to be put into a lead role, but to get paid less for it. Women are more likely than men to work full-time and yet make less for it. It's astounding. It's one of those things where every rock you uncover has got a new gender inequity problem under it. And we think this is probably true for all of the stores that have a two-tiered wage increase. We just happened to get the data from Fred Meyer and be able to demonstrate it there. And that's why we're talking about it at Fred Meyer. Because as you know, a union never does anything without documentation. So we're never going to act on suspicion. We're only going to act on the documented evidence.
What has the union said to Fred Meyer in terms of fix the wage gap, do this?
Right. So in our proposals, we put forth noticeable extensive wage increases across the board, but much higher wage increase in Schedule B. So we were going to see Schedule A get a thorough bump, but Schedule B get, you know, like a bump and a half or so, right? So that we could close the gap over time. Our ultimate goal at this point is to see that two-tiered structure go away, because I doubt that anybody's out there asking themselves, how can I discriminate against women today? I think what's happening is we're seeing a perceived history of gender roles and women's work versus men's work. And then we're also seeing that the two-tiered structure exists. Those two things together provide an opportunity for inequity. And if we remove the mechanism, then we can remove the inequity, not just for gender, but any other inequity you're looking at. If you're looking at racial discrimination, age discrimination, ableist discrimination, we think that removing that mechanism is going to go a long way towards solving all those problems simultaneously.
Yeah, and I think that has a strong message for the rest of the labor movement as far as what economic justice needs to look like, because the labor movement has a history of making compromises with employers to you know, try and do the best that seems possible in that situation, but they end up kind of creating the track work for just going further down the wrong route. And what you are talking about is backing that train up so that we can get going together.
Exactly. And we also looked, Olympic Analytics looked up a lot of historical contracts, and the stuff that they found was both stunning and not. I mean, it's exactly what you would expect, but it's horrifying.
Well, that's all the time we have for the on-air portion of my conversation with Kelly McAllister. We'd like to take a break soon to talk to you about becoming a member of KBOO, who brings you these important conversations about what our community is doing to make its world better. When you find today's show in the next few days, you'll find several more minutes of conversation between Kelly and I, where we go into the history of the way that gender was inscribed into the job descriptions at Fred Meyer's and how the union is proposing to end the legacy of that gender division. Thank you, Kelly McAllister, Communications Director of UFCW 555, for coming on the Old Mold today to talk about the important fight that Fred Meyer's workers are taking to Kroger.
Yes, thank you very much. We appreciate your support.
And that's the sound of workers agitating at a Fred Meyer store for equal wages for women workers. Since that interview was recorded, the union has called for a consumer boycott of all Fred Meyer stores. The chant, "The people united will never be defeated," is true only insofar as people really are united, and that means workers' struggles need to be supported, not just by union members, but by all of us. Just as earlier on the show, we saw that it will take all of us, and not just various groups of environmentalists, to make the changes to the way we produce and consume energy, and we will need to be organized and reorganized with this goal of life, if civilized life is to have a future on this planet. There are opportunities everywhere to build community solidarity. You may recall that a few weeks ago on the Old Mole, Desiree Helligers brought us the voices of many folks who were concerned about that the city of Portland was going to close the Columbia Pool, a vital community resource. But the community is working hard to keep it open, and you are invited. An event called the Park and Poolooza, Poolooza, is coming up at Columbia Park in North Portland on Saturday, September 28th. The free concert in support of the campaign to save North Portland's Columbia Pool. It runs from noon to 6. The pool is a critical resource for one of Portland's most diverse neighborhoods. Performers are going to include Marilyn Keller, the Roosevelt High School Jazz Band, the Zigzag Mountain Band, the Dark Mother, LaRonda Steele, Bravo Youth Orchestra, and more. So come enjoy the music, food, and games. Show your support for the campaign to save Columbia Pool. And I'm going to close out the Old Mole for this week by thanking our guests and contributors, Diane Meisenhelter, for letting us know about next Friday's rally, Holding Our City Accountable, Slow Motion Commotion. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guests, Jenna Paris, Jackson Calhoun, and Sriya Chinnam, for demonstrating the passion of the next generation of citizens and leaders to maintain the livability of the Earth. And to Joe Clement and his guest, Kelly McAllister, for letting us know about how Fred Meyer is treating its workers and what they are doing about it, which includes asking us to boycott the Fred Meyer stores. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I've been hosting this show with the help of our engineer, Patricia Kullberg. If you want to listen to all or any part of today's show again or pass it along to your friends, it will be on our webpage at kboo.fm/oldmole in a day or two. You can also subscribe to The Old Mole as a weekly podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. So tune in again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Underground Perspective.